I'm Michelle Thomas, and welcome to My Shit Therapist, a mental health podcast based on my best-selling, thank you very much, book and audiobook. I'm a writer, which means I've spent most of my career working in pubs and cafes. I'm addicted to manicures, my signature look is gender-fluid sideshow bob, and every day I take 20 milligrams of citalopram for anxiety and depression. The title of the book and the podcast comes from, well, a shit therapist. The first one I went to see when I was really, really unwell. After I'd poured my heart out about my panic attacks, her advice was, well, the next time that happens, just have a cup of tea and think about something else. Because, you know, there are people who are a lot worse off than you. 20 quid that cost me. I wrote the book because a lot of the time the current conversation about mental health focuses on breakdown and recovery. I was suicidally depressed, but now I run ultramarathons and everything's hunky-dory. And while that might be a valid journey for some people, most of us exist sort of in between the binaries of illness and wellness. We're not in crisis, but we're not well either. We're sort of moderately mad. In this podcast, I'm going to chat to lots of different people whose experiences are very different from my own about how their mental health impacts every part of their lives, from how they parent their children, to who and how they date, to where they live, to what jobs they do and why, to what they're going to have for dinner when there's no food in the fridge and they can't face a busy supermarket. If you want to hear about medication, meditation, irritations, good and bad coping mechanisms, if you want to chat breakdowns and antidepressants, I've got you. If you're having a bad mental health day, I want to hold your hand through your ears. Are you ready? Good, let's begin. Just so you know, the sound quality does dip a little bit in this episode. Sorry about that. Today I'm chatting with my lovely pal, Amy Mason. Amy is a writer, theatre maker and comedian who lives in Bristol. She has a sitcom in development about a woman who is sectioned when she suffers from postnatal depression, which is based on her own experience. And it's so good, it makes me angry and jealous. It's funny, it's brutal, and it's brilliant. We had a really great chat about mental health and motherhood and identity and medication, all kinds of juicy goodness. You're going to love it. All right, here we go. How are you?
Right, I've been finding things quite tough. I stopped drinking.
It is good, that, isn't it? Yeah.
Have you still stopped?
Yeah. I haven't had a drink since Boxing Day, and I cannot imagine how much worse I would feel if I were drinking even a bit at this time.
Yeah, I've stopped. So
how long?
It's been about 5 days now. But I've just, like, I just got really into just like every night just drinking wine.
It's so easy.
It really is. And it just makes me so irritable with the kids. Like, they're waking up at like 6 a.m. and I'm just in such a bad mood. So I don't know. It's hard, isn't it? I'm finding it hard. I'm not getting any work done, which is a bit depressing and stressful, but yeah. Mm. It's nice to do this.
Yeah, it's lovely. This morning, I went to a friend's house for the first time in 3 months because it was her birthday. And on the way, I called into the Orchard Cafe in St. George to get some pastries because I went at about 10 in the morning. And I went to the little hatch and she said, oh, you can come into the cafe. So I was able to go into the cafe and I genuinely got a bit teary because it was the first time I've been into somewhere, and it just felt really, really normal. It felt like a return of something, like I was coming back to something, but also it was so different because everything's like signposted but it was lovely. I just had to have a little moment, and I went, I'm really sorry, I'm getting a bit emotional. And she was South American, so she was like, I don't care, it's fine. It's fine to get weepy over pastry. But then I realized when I came outside, I was like, have I skipped a couple of days of citalopram? Because that's crying over pastry is new, even for me.
Get that. And I sometimes get that little electric-y feeling and like yeah, being very emotional. And then I think, oh shit, I forgot my antidepressants.
Amy Mason, What's the worst thing a therapist has ever said to you?
I think probably the worst, most upsetting for me is when I went and they didn't talk at all, and it was two of them. So I went into the room, and it was obviously like, you know, I've had that happen before where they don't talk a bit and they sort of wait for you to talk, you know? But like, even when I said, are you not going to talk? They just sat there and didn't talk at me, two of them. And I was only like 21 and I was feeling really anxious anyway. It was in this horrible building in like King's Cross, this really big, like Victorian sort of old psych hospital building. And I just sat there and they just stared at me. And I just started like having a panic attack and ended up leaving. And I went home and my housemate described me as crying like a pterodactyl. She said I was like, like snorting. I was so angry, upset. But yeah, they just wouldn't. They just didn't talk. They just sat. And it was like a good, like, you know, a good 5 minutes of me saying, you know, I'm finding this quite uncomfortable. You're not going to talk. And then just looking at me like that. That was pretty bad.
Wow. And was there a fault? Did anyone follow up with you and go?
I made a complaint and they were like really apologetic about it. But I do find that awkward with therapists always, often, that they often just sit there, you know, and wait for you to speak. And I find that I've got sort of used to it now because I've had about 150,000 therapists. But I do find that quite tough.
What do you think is the best or most helpful thing a therapist has ever said to you?
I had a therapist when I actually through Womankind, who are in Bristol, and they have like low cost therapy.
Yeah.
Yeah. And she was like one of those very like analytical kind of old school therapists. And she didn't talk much. Like, I can't even remember her name. But she was like very much like not really in the room. She was like very, but she did occasionally made pronouncements, you know? And so when she made a pronouncement, it was like very considered. And I really thought it was very wise. And I used to say, I was always convinced that like I was too ugly or fat to ever meet anyone. I wasn't in a relationship at the time. And I used to say that I felt like a monster. And she basically pointed out, I can't remember her words. I feel like she had a foreign accent. She actually didn't, but I feel like she should have had this like Germanic accent. She basically pointed out that like, I felt like my behavior was monstrous, really. And that it was like, I didn't look like a monster. And that was kind of like mind blowing for me at the time. I was like, oh wait, it's not about what I look like at all. It's like, I've got these hangovers from my childhood of like thinking that I'm this destructive person and like, yeah, like a monster basically. I think that was really useful. Yeah.
Amy's depression worsened after she gave birth to her first child.
When I had Selma, is my oldest child. And when I had her, I think my depression actually with her started in pregnancy. And I think that's actually much more common than people know. Like antenatal depression is very common, and they actually call the services normally perinatal psychiatric services because it's pre-birth as well. But for me, so much of my identity was wrapped up in being this like party girl, like drunken, like you know, just like creative, spontaneous, all these kind of things. And then I was pregnant and I just couldn't imagine myself as a mother. I didn't look after myself like at all. Like I was like, didn't, you know, my friend the other day reminded me that I laughed at her for making her bed. She was like, I was like, oh God, look at you making your bed like really nice. That's how shit I was. And, you know, I always thought things like that were like, you know, I was really immature. So it was just, I thought I'd find it very exciting when I got pregnant. And actually, I was immediately struck by this like feeling of absolute shock, like proper shock. And worry. And I felt so depressed that I couldn't really speak. I didn't speak. I think I told a few people, I told my mum, but then almost immediately after that, I went into this period where I didn't speak to my mum. I didn't talk to her or any of my family on the phone for I think a couple of months. And they were really worried about me, but I literally couldn't. I could barely speak even to my partner. I felt so worried about it all, and that maybe I was doing the wrong thing and it was going to be a complete disaster. I felt worried about my relationship with my partner, whether it was just, I just couldn't foresee that it was going to work, because I'd always had such patchy mental health. And then I went to the GP and they immediately took me off this mood stabilizer that I was on, called lamotrigine, which is also an epilepsy drug, but they used it for people with mood instability. My sort of diagnosis at the time was, they said, bipolar 2 probably, but it was some kind of mood instability. And she took me off it immediately, basically, without any tapering down or anything. I was also on, I think at the time, sertraline, which she kept me on. So that also probably had an effect. I now found out that was a really bad decision, and there's no reason why I couldn't have stayed on it, basically.
Amy was on an SSRI called sertraline and a mood stabiliser called lamotrigine. After struggling all her life with poor mental health, how did she feel about starting a family?
As soon as I had my daughter, you have these emotions of exhilaration, and it's obviously really hard giving birth. I had a natural labour, so it's a lot of pain, and then you have a baby and you have all this exhilaration and all that stuff. But I expected to get postnatal depression. Everybody expected me to. I'd already been in contact with psychiatric services, and I had a support worker sort of lined up for after the post-birth. And for the first couple of hours, I sort of thought, maybe it'll be all right. I mean, I felt slightly disconnected, but I thought, maybe it'll be all right. I didn't feel this enormous rush of love, but I thought maybe it'll be all right. And then I was in the hospital room with her, and my parents were there, and Stefan, my partner's parents, were there. And it was literally a matter of hours after I'd given birth. They'd all flocked down, and she stopped breathing. The baby stopped breathing. She was choking, and I was have just had a baby, didn't jump up. But I turned around, and my mum was press the emergency button now. So my mum grabbed the baby, and Stefan or somebody pressed the emergency button. I was just completely frozen, they rushed in, took her off, and she was went blue. They took her off. Stefan ran with her. I just sort of felt frozen and stuck in bed. And I didn't feel this enormous sort of rush, I should run after her and do it. I thought that's what I probably should do, but I didn't feel naturally I wanted to. I think part of that was, it was the embarrassment of being in my nightie and not having a bra on, and having this massive sanitary towel with my husband's parents and my parents. I felt sort of glued to the bed, and I actually thought at the time, this is the moment I get postnatal depression. this is the moment. Yeah, it was I could see me not doing, I wasn't doing what a mother should do. And it just didn't seem to come naturally to me. And I felt slow, and almost my reactions were slow. And when I was doing things that were loving or whatever, I sort of second guessed myself. am I doing this because it's what I should be doing? I did actually, you asked me actually what the worst thing a therapist has done. And actually, what I said isn't the worst thing. The worst thing was, so I was under the perinatal service and I didn't find it very helpful, actually. It's a very, one of those very odd things where I had a psychiatrist I could see and they gave me a support worker who visited the house. And the support worker was always like a different person. And I didn't really feel like I could talk to them at all, but I guess they're there to check that you're not like doing anything completely dangerous or, you know, imminent risk. And I kept begging them. I kept saying, what I really need is like one-to-one therapy. Like, I knew what I needed was just to talk to someone about all these like horrific things, like, you know, not horrific, but horrific to me, like feeling not like a mother, not maternal, not bonded, all that stuff that I felt unable to tell anyone. That's what I knew I needed, was like just to unload, really. And that just wasn't available. They gave me like 6-week CBT, which is just like general CBT, you know. And I went and it was like this 21-year-old girl with like a tick box chart
thing, like a worksheet.
Yeah. And I was like, this is just ridiculous. And then I sort of asked, and they eventually went, well, there is one thing we could do. You could go to our psychologist. And I was like, great, okay. And they were like, we want you to go as a family. So we want your husband, we weren't married, your partner to go and the baby. And we were like, okay, fine. So we turned up. And I thought it was going to be like talking therapy. No one explained what it was. And we went into this room and there were all these like skanky toys on the floor, like on this playmat. And they were like, this man and this woman were there. They didn't explain who they were or anything. They might have said, oh, we're psychologists. They were like, oh, we want you to sit on the floor. So they made me, my husband and the baby sit on the floor. And then they were like, we just want you to play. Just play with the baby. So it was like it's kind of like we were being observed. And I was very conscious that I felt like my partner did more with the baby than I did. And he was sort of generally doing a bit more. But then if I did something like gave the baby a toy, this man sort of whispered, he was sitting on a chair and I was on the floor, whispered over my shoulder, see baby, money can make you feel good too, like in a really whispery creepy voice. And I was like, oh my god, I had like tears pricking my eyes because it was like the most humiliating. And imagine, I mean, I said to them, I went about the next time, I said, how is this, does this work for anyone? I said, like, if you had an eating disorder and you like made somebody sit on the floor, eat a meal and just commented on everything that they eat and the way they ate, you know, it was like the most like humiliating. It was just so shit. So I hated that guy and I can't believe that that's his job. So yeah, that was bad. So so that's really what happened to me. It was mainly, my main symptoms really, well, I just had like general depression and like lethargy and it wasn't really lethargy. It was like, I just felt overwhelmed by everything, like getting the baby out the door, going to the coffee shop with my friends. I'd often like get halfway there and like turn around because I couldn't cope. I found everything just extremely difficult. And it is hard. I think a lot of people struggle with their first child. But I think only looking back now do I realise that I was actually very unwell. But my husband did a lot. For definitely the first year, and I think my daughter was definitely more bonded with him initially, which I did find difficult and embarrassing when we'd go out and she'd ask for him and stuff, especially around like his parents and stuff. I'd be like, oh god, you know, oh daddy, no, I want daddy, if I tried to do something with her. But then I also told myself, like, that's just sexist, isn't it? That's like a real, loads of children are like that with their mums, you know, and don't want their dads. So it's this, like, you know, these gender norms or whatever. And anyway, it's not like that anymore. Mm. So, yeah. So I went on, I think I went on antidepressants first when I was either 14 or 15, really young. Mm. And I was with the Adolescent Mental Health Service, or Children and Adolescent Mental Health Service. And then I ended up like getting thrown out of home when I was 16 because I was so destructive and depressed, really. But, it, you know, the thing my parents couldn't tolerate was my just like breaking everything in the house and having these massive like tantrums and just causing absolute chaos. So basically I've been on various different mental health medication since then. I've had some brief periods of not being on it, but I've ended up being on it again. So pretty much always. And I was very wary initially about, you know, because you read sort of in, if you do any Googling about like being on Sertraline or being on antidepressants, about getting pregnant, I was very wary from my crappy Googling. You know, I thought, oh, I'll never be able to have a child because I read some article in the Daily Mail, you know, which you can't trust at all. But actually, when I did proper research and talked to a GP and then about it, actually the risk is very low. Well, it's sort of unknown, obviously. You can't really do experiments on pregnant women. But largely, they think the risk is very low. The main risk is to a baby is that they might have withdrawal after birth. But the psychiatrist I saw said that in her like 30-year career, she'd actually never seen a child have that, a baby have that, and it's almost like a theoretical risk rather than an actual risk. So in terms of the actual like the health of a baby, I was like quite I sort of thought, okay, hopefully it'll be all right about medication. There's a massive taboo about people taking medication in pregnancy, but I think I've been on it for so long and I sort of did listen to the experts about it. He said it, they thought it was okay. And but obviously the idea, I think it was more the idea of me being a mother, having a child, was the biggest worry, especially with like having mood instability. The idea that I might just lose it in some way, like either become like in some way hypomanic and do a runner and, you know, go to fucking, I don't know, France, or do a runner and do something crazy, or just have a really, really serious period of depression. But after I met my partner and I'd had this relatively stable time of like a couple of years, and I started thinking maybe these thoughts I've got about myself and my behaviour are outdated, and perhaps I'm over that, or at least over the worst of it. And yeah, maybe it's something that wouldn't be the end of the world. I've had this like vague thought, and I was trying to formulate it before I started speaking to you today. Like, I think there's something in the fact that if you've had a lot of therapy and you've thought about your mental health a lot, you end up, I don't know anyone who's had a lot of therapy who doesn't end up blaming their parents. How, even if your therapist will be like, let's not talk about blame here. But I especially ended up like being very critical of decisions my parents had made and, you know, analysing everything in the way they treated me. And if you're a person who's done that, then to give birth, you're like, oh shit. Like, well, it's two things. It's one is like, well, it's like suddenly you're the parent. So you're like, well, okay, so they're going to do all of that to me. But I'm a state. I'm a disaster. And I'm the baby here. I'm the one who's meant to be like listened to and forgiven for all my wrongdoings, and you know, it's other people's fault, other people's in the past. And suddenly that's not the case, and you're like, oh shit, I'm like, you know, I'm gonna be somebody else's monster. And that's really scary. You're like, yeah. I don't know what conclusion that is to draw, really, apart from, yeah, that definitely added to my, you know, it's like criticizing myself.
Yeah. Do you still see a therapist?
No, I've just, I'm starting to see one again next week, actually. No, I mean, it's so expensive, isn't it?
It's prohibitively expensive, isn't it? Mm. Yeah. Still on meds?
Yeah, I stopped, so I didn't ever go back on the lamotrigine. I didn't ever think it was necessarily needed. I stayed on, now I take venlafaxine, which is, for me, I was on an SSRI for so long. I think they just sort of stopped working. In any case, I did try something different, which is an SNRI, which is slightly different.
Mm-hmm.
And I found them really good, actually, really, really good. I think I would happily stay on medication for the rest of my life.
Yeah.
Absolutely. I think that's something that I would really, you know, like to say in this interview is, you know, when I did write a show about my experience of perinatal depression, and I spoke to this researcher, I think I said, like, mm-hmm. Irina Peterson, and she does like she's an epidemiologist, she does these studies into looking at pregnant women's like behavior and medication.
Mm-hmm.
And she found out that like people in general think that the risk of taking antidepressants in pregnancy is about the same as alcohol. They think they're about as dangerous as alcohol. That's what people's perception of risk is.
Mm.
And that's not true at all. It's just above like smoking, I think it is. Just like slightly less than smoking. And which is just bullshit. And out of all the women who start taking, who are on antidepressants at the start of pregnancy, only 10% will still be on them at the end of pregnancy, because 90% of them come off of antidepressants. And that's because of like just this massive stigma, a lack of really good evidence.
That's really scary.
It is when like the published data says 1 in 10 women get postnatal depression, but actually it's way more than that. They think actually more like 1 in 5 would actually meet the clinical criteria, and then loads more have like depressive symptoms. And obviously the women who've been treated for depression before have much higher risk.
Mm-hmm.
So I think there's so many people are falling through the gaps because of this stigma against mental health medication.
Mm.
And no good available evidence, or the GPs aren't conveying the sort of available evidence.
Mm. But also, how would you know? I wouldn't necessarily know to go to my GP and say, can you show me the evidence?
Mm-hmm.
In my 10-minute GP appointment, I wouldn't necessarily have the nous to go in and go, can you show me the clinical research that's relevant to the particular antidepressant that I'm taking, the particular brand that I'm taking, and the impact that it has on women in my age group in the UK and globally. Yeah. You know, I think sometimes I feel like you feel like you should have a PhD before you agree to take any medication, because yeah, rationally and logically, it does make sense to do a lot of research, and it does make sense to compare and contrast these symptoms against the withdrawal symptoms of a particular antidepressant. But honestly, when you're ill, you just go to the doctor and just say, make me better. And they give you a prescription and you say, thanks very much, and skip to the chemist.
But I had like, I mean, even when, because I knew so much more when I had my second child and I went to the GP. And she tried to take me off my antidepressants, the GP. And this is really common. Like, they just,
they're very wary, they're risk averse, and when you get pregnant, everything becomes about the fetus and the baby and the fetus, not about you. And they're really risk averse, and so they just think, let's, just in case there's a risk, let's take you off. When actually, the risk of having a mother who's got, there's definitely published evidence that does exist about people, women who have stress and anxiety in pregnancy, that are negative outcomes, lower birth weights for babies, and obviously the risk of having postnatal depression, like so many different risks. Like that are demonstrable and like real.
I asked Amy if and how she speaks to her children about mental health.
It's hard. She's seen me taking my antidepressants.
Yeah.
And I've never really said, I've never really said what it is for yet. I've said if I felt, luckily, touch wood, I haven't had any major depressive episodes. It is harder to, I don't find I get into the same kind of depression as I did before, probably because of venlafaxine's really good, partly. But obviously, looking after children, I do have to just do things. I can't just take to my bed. Obviously that would be different if I was like going through like a chronic, like an acute episode of, so far that hasn't happened, touch wood. So I've never had to say anything. If I'm feeling, I do get quite tearful. I'm quite a tearful person. I'm not a very resilient person. So if I like cry, I say, oh God, I'm feeling really stressed out. I'm so sorry. I'm feeling really stressed out. Like, what should we do? Let's do something nice or something. So I do say that.
And what's her response to that?
Oh, I'll give you a hug and make you feel better or something like that. But I think that's probably all right. I think it's probably all right to see people cry. And, you know, it's normally when things are quite stressful, it's like, you know, like I've got a million different things happening and it's just, you know, things are just too much, overwhelming. I'm really lucky to be in a relationship with, you know, to be in a relationship, because it means that if I am feeling shit, you know, there's somebody else I can say I'm going to go and have a bath or something.
Yeah.
It must be much harder for like sole parents, single parents. I think that would be really difficult.
It's not always easy to speak to your parents about poor mental health. How does Amy talk to her parents now?
I think when I was young, it was like so obvious, you know, something was like quite majorly wrong. I still don't really know what was going on exactly, but it was like probably a combination of things, so just being general teenagerness and rebellion. They were quite strict, my parents, and it was just a lot of different things. I did then definitely talk to them. I think about the postnatal depression stuff, I didn't really, because I found it very hard to, my mum's quite sort of got quite an idealized view of parenting and hasn't really ever had any mental health problems herself. And I remember her saying once, oh, I'm quite worried about you, Amy. And I said, why? Thinking, no shit. Like, and she said something like, because you say you like your baby, you don't love, you know, you didn't say you love her, you said you liked her. And I found it really irritating, because it was like, as if, you know, as if she'd caught me out somehow when I was desperately, I wasn't hiding anything. I was like, it was all very obvious to me and it was very open. Like, if you had any sense, you could see how much I was struggling and how difficult everything was. And you know, as with all mental health conditions, and, you know, people can point out, oh, I think you're depressed, I'm really worried about you, I think I'm depressed. And you can be like, well, yeah, no shit. What now? Yeah, I am. But like, you telling me that or pointing that out doesn't help anything. It's like, my treatment options are really limited because, you know, the NHS is in crisis. And, you know, I'm already under a perinatal team, a psychiatric team at the time. It's like, and, if anything I could say on this podcast is like, having had postnatal depression, it's almost like you see the world, when you see new parents, I see them in a different way to other people. I think I can see often that when people are really struggling, which is sort of more often than not, I would say, with their first child, people are often really struggling and have, even if they don't have like clinical postnatal mental illness, I think a lot of them have really disturbing or worrying thoughts or not how they thought it would be. And I think sort of one of the most, you know, important things I think to say to a new parent, rather than saying, oh, don't you love them so much, or you must be so happy, is saying, how are you feeling how are you to a new parent? And often they will actually tell you. And often people do say some really worrying sounding stuff and it's just laughed off. I've had like being in a group of mothers and one of them will go like, oh, you know, sometimes I just want to let the pram go and roll down the hill. And everyone will be like, ah! And I was like, took her to one side afterwards and was like, you feeling really shit? You know, it's not like, that's not funny. That's like, really, you know, you feel terrible. So I think people often are crying out for help. And it's not really.
And what happened then? Did she laugh it off, or did she say?
No, she's like, I feel terrible. She did feel really bad. But I think especially, I think this particular person hadn't had any treatment for mental ill health in the past. Mm. So would have probably been quite reluctant to go, you know, to the GP or go on antidepressant medication. I think she found some counselling herself. But it seems, in my experience, anecdotally, really, really common for people to have really dark thoughts sometimes, and often they just get through it. And I wish that they didn't have to, because I can see sometimes people have been going through like agony, really. And if they don't have the background of talking about their mental health or knowing who to approach, don't know what to do about it. I like bumped into one of my neighbours when I lived in London, who I barely knew, and she started crying in the street. She had a new baby, and I asked her if like she wanted me to take the baby, and I literally sat with this baby from this woman I didn't know in my front room in a rocking chair for like an hour and a half so she could sleep. And she was like the perfect, you know, from the outside, like the absolute perfect mother, you know, she's like the crafty Instagram, you know, perfect everything, you know, always doing crafts with her kids. And and I think people do really, really struggle, but there's sort of like this, it's always like postnatal depression is seen as like this hormonal anomaly. And I think postpartum psychosis definitely is, where people have this like actual psychosis. But I think there's a range of postnatal mental illness, and I think some depression is like very normal considering the, you know, what you're going through, lack of sleep deprivation, your entire identity, which is what most people I know have struggled with, like changing relationship with your partner, changes, you're earning less money. It's like a perfect storm of just shit, and you don't suddenly become a superhuman when you become a parent. You're exactly the same person, and yet all this stuff, your body's changed, all this stuff happens. So yeah, I don't know what to say really about it, but I just do think it is much more normal and common than people think.
If someone's listening to this podcast and they think they're struggling with postnatal depression, what's the next step?
Well, I would say Google whatever's in your area. So I would look up like PANDAS is a national charity, which is like postnatal, PANDAS, and they have like support groups And they can send you like a pack. There's Bluebell in Bristol, there's Cocoon Family Support in London. Just Google like your area and like postnatal depression. Go to your GP and say that you'd like a referral, if possible. Try and actually say the words, because sometimes they won't. So say you'd like a referral to a postnatal mental health team or perinatal mental health team if you can. See if your partner, if you've got a partner, can take some time off work. See if you've got a parent or family member who can come and look after your child. Ask them to ask for help, practical help. If you've got any money, try and get a cleaner. I know cleaners, that's really controversial at the moment, but I think, you know, it can really help to just feel like somebody's just come and cleaned, or ask a friend to do it and you'll say you'll do it for them in the future. I think a lot of practical stuff is really helpful. Getting like ready meals, ordering a takeaway if you feel like shit and not thinking you have to cook. But all that stuff, I'd say if you think you're at risk of postnatal depression, or even if you're just worried about having a baby, because it's a lot of stuff that I put in place with my second child, because obviously I knew that I was at risk,
yeah,
especially, and I didn't get it with my second child. I felt fine, and I think a lot of that was to do with stuff like putting in place, making sure my husband had loads of paternity leave. So like investigate shared leave if you can, because often like you can do shared parental leave now, and often like men don't take it, so try and look into that, see if they can get some more time off. Like if you've got any money, like try and get some childcare. Like I would even go as far as to like borrow money, like if you're not going to get yourself into horrendous debt, to get some help if possible. You can get people like postnatal doulas and people who come and help you, or nannies. I mean, I don't have that kind of money, but we did actually interview somebody to do that, because we were thinking if things got bad, we would try and find the money to do it, to have somebody. There, the baby's just woken up, my husband's just gone to go. I think protecting your sleep, and like I think with my second child, because I knew you don't become this like new person who can just survive with no sleep. Well, I didn't anyway, and some people seem to say that they do, but I couldn't. So I just thought of it like I was nocturnal.
Yeah.
And I just thought, with my first, I was trying so hard to like get sleep, and the second I was like, no, I'm giving myself over to it, I'm accepting it.
Mm.
And I just, all these like really nice Cadbury's like brunch bars, and like, you know, like loads of like nice snacks and nuts and stuff, and I would just sit up at night, and I just knew that I would be awake all night breastfeeding. And my husband, I put him, we just didn't even try and share a room, which was really good, because it meant that he was in another room, he got sleep, then in the morning he could get up with the older child and then take the baby for a couple of hours, I could get sleep, and we had it was like a proper like shift work, you know.
Mm.
Rather than like thinking, oh, we're going to be really romantic and sleep in a bed together and neither of us get any sleep, we were like, no, we're going to treat it like, because it's only like 6 weeks at the beginning of no sleep, and then it normally settles down. But yeah, it's really hard. Tell your friends, talk to people. A lot of people are feeling really crap, and often it's the people you do not expect. Yeah. Sometimes the people who seem like they're doing so well are really, really struggling. But it is really hard. But if you are struggling now, you will get through it. And even if you feel like you've got no bonds with your child, you're never going to have any bonds with your child, I absolutely do. Me and my daughter love each other. You know, my older child, we love each other so much. And we have a great bond. But it just did take a while.
Mm.
And I think that's fine. Just do the right things, just do the things automatically, do it, treat it like a job. Don't think that you've got to love it, just do it. And the loving it will come.
That's brilliant, thank you.
Oh, that was dead good. I loved that, and I love Amy. You can follow her on Twitter @AmyCMason.
thank you so much for listening, especially if you've made it all the way through. If you've come this far, you might as well give it 5 stars, really, and subscribe, hadn't you? It'd be a bit rude not to, wouldn't it? You can also follow My Shit Pod on Twitter. I'd love to hear the best and worst mental health advice you've been given. You can also email me at myshittherapist@gmail.com. Coming up next on the My Shit Therapist podcast, we've got loads of big magic chats coming up. I can't wait for you to hear them. So until next time, take care and take your meds. Bye! My Shit Therapist is produced by Albert Davis. Special thanks to Jack Duff for the music.